You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 116, covering the week of April 9th through April 13th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Before we get started, all the usual things. Why don't you go on out and like us on Facebook at Abbeville Institute, follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, and subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all of those social media buttons at the top of our page, abbevilleinstitute.org. While you're there, give us an email address and we'll give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales Emancipation Hell. You'll also get our daily dose of Dixie by giving us an email address and our weekly email either on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. Also, if you do like what we do, you can help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. You can go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says Support. Click on that, and it'll give you an option for donor options. On there, you can find all of the levels that you can help us financially. The Abbeville Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so your donations are tax-deductible to the full extent of the law. And you can donate monthly as little as $3 a month if you're a student, or $5 a month if you're not a student, or as little as $25 a year, or $50 a year correspondingly. So go on out there and look at all of our options. We do have many different levels to help us out. Also, you can help us financially by going to our Amazon Smile account. If you look at our Abbeville Institute webpage, at the top of the page, you'll see a little Amazon, little A button. Click on that. And as you shop at Amazon, you will be helping the Abbeville Institute as well. It's painless, so go on out there and get that. Okay, all of that said, oh, and by the way, on our YouTube account, we do have all of the recent lectures up there from our conference in February. So we have them on the on the webpage, under the lectures button. We've got them on the YouTube page. And now we also have them on our app, which you can get if you go out to your app store, Google Play, iTunes, whatever you got. You can get download our Abbeville Institute app, and you can enjoy the Abbeville Institute on the go through the application. Okay, all of that said, let's get started with the week that was at the Abbeville Institute. And we're going to start with something that wasn't on the website, but of course is something I've been warning about for now, it seems like, ever since we've been doing this podcast. But yesterday was Thomas Jefferson's birthday, so we'll start with the Friday article, but also with something that happened on Thomas Jefferson's birthday. The statue at the University of Virginia was, of course, vandalized. And this is something that we predicted. The Confederate monuments that are under attack are the low-hanging fruit in all of this process of destroying not only the Southern tradition and Southerners in general, but also Western civilization. And the attack is not just on Southern monuments and Southern heroes. It's on Western civilization. And Thomas Jefferson, at his own university, these students that go there, and of course I'm sure it was students who attend UVA that did this, they're attending his university. It wouldn't be there without Thomas Jefferson, and yet they're going to go out and vandalize a statue. And so this is indicative of the climate in which we live, and we've got another piece that goes along with that. Students today, and it's not really their fault. I mean, they're taught from the beginning, and we're going to look at that with a piece on Monday. They're taught from the time they're little pups there in their government-run schools that the United States is evil, that there are victims in society, and these victims need to lash out at the people that were their oppressors in one way or another. And so then you have the willing accomplices, the people that, again, feel sorry for the people that are the victim class, whatever class that is. I mean, you have it across the board. It doesn't really matter who you're talking about. There's victims in, seems like, every group of people. And so then you have their accomplices, and so then you create this climate where you get people, again, lashing out. And all they really learn in all of this are slogans. They don't really learn anything that is, they're not intellectually curious. They learn slogans. And so when you look at Thomas Jefferson, of course, what was spray painted on, you know, he's a racist, a rapist. Of course, there's no conclusive proof that Thomas Jefferson ever did anything like that. In fact, the person that wrote the article for Friday was on a panel that concluded that Jefferson didn't do what he was accused of, and that, of course, is the Sally Hemings affair. So it doesn't really matter. The evidence doesn't matter. the material that you can produce doesn't matter. It's all about image and perception. And so this is a problem that we have. You know, the Confederate statues are going to go away. I think over time, there's going to be many that will stay up because the states are trying to work to block some of these things. And you might have them stay up in a lot of states. But even in those states, there's going to be resistance to it. And in some cases, you're probably going to see the statues taken down. New Orleans was supposed to not be able to take these things down through legislation in Louisiana, but it happened anyways. So we'll see what happens there. I'm sure it's still in court and they're trying to work this out. But even if all the statues come down, when they do come down, the process is not going to stop. The attack is going to be on George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and it's already started. And then there was an attack on a statue of William McKinley in California, a guy that wasn't even from the South, from Ohio, but yet because of the Spanish-American War and because of the American or the American involvement in the Filipinos, the Filipino-American War, McKinley is seen as a bad guy. Are we going to take the statue down, or are we going to take anything down that mentions William Howard Taft, for example? Is he going to be one of the individuals who's attacked because he called the Filipino people his little brown brothers? Are we going to do that? Are we going to attack statues of Teddy Roosevelt because Roosevelt was involved in that war as well? Are we going to do that? So, I mean, where do you stop with this process is the question. And we start with that episode in Virginia because, again, it's a clear indication that it's not going to stop at Confederate statues. But that said, let's talk about the piece we did have on Friday that had to do with Jefferson the President, written by Forrest MacDonald. And it's the preface to his book, The Presidency of Thomas Jefferson, which was published in 1976. So the bicentennial of the Declaration. And it's a wonderful little book. You can get it for next to nothing now on Amazon or other places. Actually, I read it as an undergraduate. That was the book that was assigned to me on Thomas Jefferson, which was marvelous because now you probably won't get that from your modern crop of professors. But as an undergraduate, anyways, you might read it as a graduate student, but probably not. So you've got this little book on Forrest MacDonald, by Forrest MacDonald. And the cool thing about this book is that Forrest MacDonald, of course, when he wrote the book, he was living in Florida, and he had moved to the South, and he had spent most of his academic career in the North. And Forrest MacDonald then later taught University of Alabama, where he retired, became emeritus professor of history, and he wrote wonderful books on the founding generation, on the Constitution. He, in fact, testified before Congress in the 1980s on the Constitution. But the great thing about this book is that MacDonald announces his biases. Forrest MacDonald was a Hamiltonian. He said as much. Throughout most of his life, he said he was a Hamiltonian. He leaned to that side. And his biography on Alexander Hamilton is very good. He is extremely laudatory of Alexander Hamilton, and I find problems with that. And of course, when I wrote my book on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America, I took apart some of the things that were said about Hamilton. But Forrest MacDonald was a great historian. And one of the interesting things about MacDonald is that he always said he never really read the secondary literature. He only read the primary material. He had his wife read the secondary literature and then summarize some of these things to him, and so he would know it. But MacDonald always said he didn't really spend much time in the secondary literature. He focused on the primary material and let that speak for itself, and then he wrote the book. And I think that's, for those that are looking to do history, that's really the way to go. We can talk shop. You can have, well, I know this book, and I know this historian, and I know that story. In some ways, that's a pointless exercise, because when you do that and you have to go and you spend chapters summarizing what every other historian has said, even if it's not really worthwhile, it's ridiculous. And I know historiography is interesting. We want to learn what different historians said. But really, the part of history that's the important part is getting into the primary material and writing the book. And so you don't really focus on that secondary literature as much. And this is something that MacDonald was very good at, taking the primary material and bringing it to life. And he was a good writer. But the great thing about this little preface, he says, look, I'm a Hamiltonian, but I'm going to write this book on Jefferson, and Jefferson is going to speak. And he talked about moving to Florida and becoming a farmer, at least working in the soil. And he started to appreciate Thomas Jefferson for that. he started to appreciate what Jefferson was for that. He got down into the soil and he started working as a Jeffersonian. And I think that's really, that's why I like that little preface, because he mentions that. And he talks about some of the other historiography that was going on, and look at Bolingbroke and some of the, he talks about Jefferson Longview. And how Jefferson is really an extension of this British opposition to the English Financial Revolution, excuse me. So he said this is, you know, Jeffersonianism came from England. He's tracing it back there to Great Britain, which is an interesting position, interesting perspective. It's, you know, a little longer durée. It wasn't created then here in America, which is a different look at Jeffersonianism. But I like this little essay because you have a Hamiltonian writing about Jefferson, and this book is pretty good. I mean, he doesn't criticize Jefferson. He talks about Henry Adams and how critical Henry Adams was of the Jefferson administration. But I think McDonald's little book is a fairly even-handed look at the Jefferson presidency. And there's no doubt that Jefferson was off the rails in his second term. Even in my 9 presidents who screwed up America, Jefferson is one of the 4 who tried to save her, but I'm critical of Jefferson in his second term. And I think that's the important thing. You know, this is where McDonald is being very even-handed in this and saying, you know, Jefferson was doing some things that weren't really consistent with Jeffersonianism. So, of course, it was Jefferson's birthday, and it's nice to have a little piece on Thomas Jefferson on Jefferson's birthday. So it's not a long piece, but going out there and take a look at that. And then we get into Monday's piece, and it's kind of this same thing where I was talking about where students really don't know anything. And this is a piece that we wrote because one of our scholars, somebody that attended one of our conferences, summer school, many years ago, was under attack at the University of South Carolina for what one student called head-on racism. And when you look at the circumstances surrounding what happened, and this piece was written by Don Livingston, the president of the Institute, when you look at what happened, you can't really conclude that from the evidence, but the student, because this is all they've been told to think, thinks it for some reason. So Tobias Lance was teaching a political science course, and a cell phone went off, and he was talking about welfare and the American welfare system, and he said, oh, it must be the welfare office calling. Now, he does this all the time when a cell phone goes off. If he's talking about Russia and Syria, he'll say, it must be the Russians calling. He does this all the time because a cell phone interrupts. He doesn't even see whose cell phone it is. He can't see that. As a professor myself, you don't know whose cell phone it is when it goes off, unless the student's reaching around in their bag and you can see it very clearly what happened. But this is in a class of 200 students. There's no way he knew whose cell phone that was. But the student comes up and records him, has a little confrontation with him, and she says, you know, she was upset because she sees that as offensive to her. Now, then she posts it on social media, and then it becomes this big viral thing. She says, I've experienced head-on racism in South Carolina. If you look at the video, there's no way that can even be considered that. No way. He didn't direct the comment. Even the students are saying, he didn't know which phone was ringing. And in fact, when you look at the facts about welfare, and of course, the student was African-American, because she's claiming that Lance, who's saying this is head-on racism. When you look at the facts of welfare, there's more white Americans on welfare than any other group. So it's funny how, you know, these things are perceived, but the present university, this is really where it really gets into the problem. This could have been handled by the department. It could have been handled in a much different fashion with Lance himself and the student. But the president of the institution comes out and apologizes for the University of South Carolina, saying that we don't. And then they had this big, anti-racism rally on campus. I mean, this is just stupid. It's ridiculous. They're doing this all over something that really, even 10 years ago, would have been, nobody would have said anything about. But and the fact is, Lance can't be accused of anything. Now, what is his crime? How did Lance? And this was published in the state newspaper. And, of course, what they did is bring up that he spoke before the Abbeville Institute, and he gave a lecture entitled The Agrarianism of Wendell Berry. And somehow this proves, because he spoke before the Abbeville Institute, that he is a racist. And why? And the piece says, quote, Wendell Berry is a Southern poet, agrarian advocate, and critic of industrial capitalism who is admired around the world, mostly by progressive-leaning environmentalists. This agrarian criticism of the dark side of industrial capitalism has, from the time of Thomas Jefferson, been a central theme of the Southern tradition. Indeed, Eugene Genovese, a Northerner and Marxist, described by the Atlantic Monthly as America's greatest living historian, said that the South has developed the best critique of the dark side of liberalism. Lance discussed Wendell Berry in relation to the Southern tradition. He had some kind words to say about the Confederacy and Robert E. Lee and the culture that produced them, and he had no problem with displaying the Confederate flag as a symbol of that culture, positions that until recently were widely held by Americans North and South. But this is why he's called a racist, because he spoke before the Abbeville Institute. Now, the Abbeville Institute is not a racist organization, absolutely. But because he gives a lecture where he praises Robert E. Lee or the Confederacy, he's now a racist. This is just, this is George Orwell kind of stuff. I mean, this is 1984. It doesn't even make any sense. And so the problem is, all of this, what the president of the University of South Carolina is doing is propping up a culture that's anti-intellectual, anti-academic, and the antithesis of the liberal arts education and the free exchange of ideas. This is what's happening here. But, it doesn't matter. The students who spray-painted the Jefferson statue are part of this climate. And, of course, this student is as well. And, it's not their fault. This is what they're taught. So we can't really have people discussing a free exchange of ideas if we have this kind of climate. People are going to be afraid to say anything. That's the problem. People are going to be afraid to say anything. They're going to be afraid to come to class. They're going to be afraid to talk about material that might be sensitive, or this is where you get these trigger warnings and safe spaces and all that kind of stuff. They're going to be afraid to do it. And how do you have a real education then? You're just going to be able to teach what the students find acceptable. Well, then who runs the class at that point? This is the sad thing about all of this. So we had to respond as the Abbeville Institute and say, look, I mean, you're painting the Abbeville Institute, a picture of the Abbeville Institute that's not true, number one. And number two, the guy didn't do anything wrong. But yet he has to apologize, or the university has to apologize, and you have to have this big rally. I mean, this is just silly. But that's the climate in which we live. And part of that is because, as Jonathan Harris asked the question on Wednesday, why do historians lie, and when do they lie? And he cites some of the things that Clyde Wilson has said in his great book, Defending Dixie, that the South is constantly being berated. And that's because of indoctrination. It's because of indoctrination. And so historians lie, as Jonathan Harris says, because they want to indoctrinate people. Now, you could say this is using history as a weapon. I mean, you could say that this is happening for any historian. All historians are biased. There's no doubt about it. The problem is that many historians don't announce their biases. They just do it. And then people think they're being objective. This is where the book by a man named Novick, That Noble Dream, is so important to read. If you've never read it, it's, again, entitled That Noble Dream, and it's by Novick. He talks about historical biases. And he goes back through personal correspondence and other things, and he talks about how objectivity is never the goal of the historian. It never is. Your goal as a historian is always to tell the world the way you see it, or tell the story the way you see it. That's it. And you're basically making a case for your position on history. History is this. It's not sufficient anymore just to go out and say this is what the evidence is. These are all the sides of the story. You're never going to do that. And even when you try, you're going to maybe give lip service to the other side, but you're going to try to take it apart. And look, historians that announce their biases, when I write my book, I think it's very clear when I write my books, for example, what I think about things. When I have How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, obviously it's not going to be a pro-Hamilton book, right? Or Nine Presidents Who Screwed Up America. Obviously the people in there I'm going to be very critical of, and they're on the cover of the book. Or The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers, right? It's not going to be something that is PC. But that's the important thing. I announce my biases. Now, we can do this in popular history, but academic history is a little more, and those are popular history books. Academic history is a little more nuanced, and so you're not going to get those biases. And you do find some good academic historians who try to be as even-handed as they can and who allow the material to speak for themselves. And when you find those books, they're wonderful because you can say, wow, anybody can get something out of that then. But historians generally, particularly when you get to the study of the South, you have a lot of people who are intending to be very critical of the South. They're trying to find fault with it. And anyone who is pro-South and tries to find something, take Eugene Genovese, a man who's written wonderful books on the South, but he was called, he's a Northerner, a Marxist, and he was accused of being, you know, a neo-Confederate, for example. Genovese never was. But he had kind things to say, and he took Southerners seriously. He critically examined the South for what it was, and not what everyone thought it was. And that made him, quote, a neo-Confederate, because he had a critical examination of the South. Or David Hackett Fisher, who does the same thing. Can't be accused of being anything but a good historian, but yet, because he doesn't bash the South, he's not critical. He can be called, or Gary Gallagher. Gary Gallagher's The Confederate War. It's a wonderful book. He wrote a book entitled The Union War, he's very critical of the South. I mean, but he wrote a book entitled The Confederate War, which was very even-handed in treatment of the South. So when you find these things, they're good, and you find it from mainstream historians, but a lot of mainstream historians can't pull this off. They write polemics, and that's the problem. And so this little book is actually talking about Christianity and how that's wrapped into this, and this little piece by Jonathan Harris. It's really good. He says, history is interpreted in the light of a worldview. This is true. The Christian worldview that created the Western world and led to the formation of the United States is no longer the lens through which the historian views his subject. This shift is more than a moral one. It also involves direction, he says. History is no longer composed of stories leading toward a point of biblical consummation. America is no longer viewed as a place in which men and women ordained by God live, learn, and move toward an eternal purpose with a duty to form their culture into a reflection of that purpose through the gentle and patient providence of God. So, that lens is gone, and it's been replaced by something else, and usually a Marxist narrative. Even those who aren't considered Marxists, though, when you look at someone like Victor Davis Hanson, who writes for the National Review, he's part of Conservative Inc., quote-unquote, they don't like the South either. And in fact, I think these people are more problematic than someone who is an devoted Marxist, and a devoted Marxist, and someone who is a devout Marxist, and someone who is interested in pursuing that. The Conservative Inc., the Fox News group, they're more problematic than anyone else because they call themselves conservatives, but they're really not. You look at the most recent travesty that's on Fox News, it's their Legends and Lies, the quote-unquote Civil War, and the way the South is portrayed in that is just awful. It's just downright terrible. And eventually, I'm sure we'll have a review of this thing on the website when they conclude the series. But it's just pathetic how bad this thing is. But when you look at the person who is in charge of this, it's Brian Kilmeade. And of course, the title comes from Bill O'Reilly's book. You'll find that what these people are advocating is no different than what Eric Foner or someone else would advocate. And the way they portray Southerners, and it's just appalling. There's no nuance. Southerners are evil. The Southerners are just these stupid hayseeds who don't know what they're doing. Stupid racist hayseeds who don't know what they're doing. The North is just these enlightened individuals who believe that they're going to go to war to end slavery. I mean, this is the problem. This is Victor Davis Hanson, who writes at National Review. He writes pieces trying to connect the progressives like Elizabeth Warren with the South. It's just so silly. Now, we can get into the debate of was the South progressive? And certainly you had Eugene Genovese saying in his Slaveholder's Dilemma that the South was trying to be progressive, and there was a certain part of their worldview that they intended to be progressive. But that said, to say that Southerners are, at the time, in the traditional South, are progressives, it's just simply ridiculous. And, of course, anytime he's written stories about how California, the secession movement in California, how, you know, California has gone Dixie and all these other kind of things, And of course, he's from California, so he's very much against this. But he's a national Republican. He's a Hamiltonian. This is the national greatness conservatism that has just saturated conservative ink. They like Teddy Roosevelt. They like Abraham Lincoln. And these people are not conservative. Teddy Roosevelt was by no means conservative. And of course, they applaud any type of foreign policy objective that's going to go out, as we just saw yesterday, and bomb Syria. So this is all part of it. The South is the antithesis of that, and so they tear it down all the time. But the problem here is that these people are considered to be conservative, and they're not. They're not conservatives. They're not conservatives. And that's the issue that people have to, that you have to separate these things. And as Boyd Cathy points out in this piece, a Southerner has to decide, are they going to read National Review any longer? Are they going to even follow Fox News? Are they going to do this stuff? And if we didn't, if Southerners actually said, look, you keep bashing the South, we're not going to pay attention to you as much anymore. It's going to hurt their bottom line because Southerners, more than any other group, are in that conservative ink realm, right? And so if Southerners just say enough, we're not going to pay attention to something that is going to bash us as a people, to bash our ancestors. Our ancestors weren't bad people, as Victor Davis Hanson. I mean, basically, in that Legend and Lives, they said that the rebel yell was, quote-unquote, demonic. Demonic. So now Southerners are demons. It's just silly. I mean, it's worse than that stupid movie, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer, where Southerners were vampires. They weren't even human. But now this is in a mainstream, that's a silly little movie, this is in a mainstream, quote-unquote, educational documentary that Southerners are going to be watching because they watch Fox News, and now your people are called demonic. Think about that. This is Victor Davis Hanson. This is Conservative Inc. This is what we get through Fox News and other outlets like that. So that's the real problem. It's the portrayal of people in the South as being subhuman, backwards, stupid, it's over the top. And of course, Victor Davis Hanson teaches at Hillsdale College, and Hillsdale College is seen as the primary conservative university in the country. They have all their, you know, advertisements on the Rush Limbaugh show and the Sean Hannity show and all that other kind of stuff. So we need to move away from that, is the point. You need to get away from those outlets and support things like this, support things like the Abbeville Institute, which tries to push back against this stuff. And last but not least, the piece on Tuesday was a book review entitled The Unknown Confederate West, written by Alvin Josephy, who's the author of the book. The review is written by Al Benson. But again, this is, ties into this anti-intellectual, unknown part of the American history in the antebellum period, because not many people know about the Confederate West. And so when you have an anti-intellectual environment, you would think that the West was fully behind the Confederacy. It was just this little group of, you know, hayseeds, stupid hayseeds in the South, and that all these people were against it. But when you look at it in the bigger picture, you find that Arizona, for example, there's a lot of people in Arizona who are for the Confederacy. In California, a large percentage of the population of California was pro-South. There was secessionist sentiment in Montana. And the town of Virginia City, the mining town in Montana, was at first named Verena City in honor of Jefferson Davis's wife. And then you have the Indian tribes in the West that were pro-Confederate. So the West is such an interesting place. If you've never been out there, I mean, I know a lot of people may not have traveled to the West, but it's like a whole other country in so many ways. But still, you had a Confederate West. You had Confederate sympathizers out West. And so it's important to understand this bigger picture, that a lot of Americans supported the South all over the United States, North, West, South, of course. And this is why for years it was cool to be a Confederate soldier in movies and other things. Everyone wanted to be that soldier. No one wanted to be the Union guy. They wanted to be the Confederate soldier because in many ways, in their mind, that represented the real American tradition. It's resisting the central authority. And so that's what that meant to them. When you had Northern actors wanted to play Confederate soldiers, it was, yeah, we're going to be the gray because the gray I mean, that's, you know, still this underdog story. Everyone likes an underdog, and the South was the underdog. And so they wanted to play that underdog. And those people were seen as good Americans. Maybe in their mind, you could say, well, they were wrong for seceding. Maybe it wasn't the time to secede. Maybe this was just a wrong thing to do, but they were still good Americans following a dedicated American position. And Northerners recognized that too, even after the war. Well, they were doing what they thought was in honor of the founding generation. We were doing what we thought was in honor of the founding generation. Let's shake hands, forget about it. We'll say it was a mistake and move on. But you can't even do that anymore because you have an anti-intellectual climate around the United States. And that's why the Abbeville Institute exists, to provide that voice in this anti-intellectual climate, to try to just say, look, what's going on now? This is crazy. This is crazy what's happening in American academy and what's happening to American education and how the South is portrayed. This stuff is just crazy. Until next time, good day.